BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Morning, I'm John Pienaar. Welcome to Pienaar's Politics in a tent at Latitude in the sun in Suffolk. Hope it's nice where you are, although I'm told it's cloudy in Belfast. Sorry about that. You might be able to hear through the show, I get once or twice, the sound of sound checks going on the main stage over to my left. So bear with us where that's concerned. And they're bearing with us, so we can, you know, return the favour. And there's a lot to get through this weekend. Everyone's enjoying themselves, maybe trying to forget politics just for the weekend. And we're going to put a stop to that. George Parker is here from the Financial Times. And so is Marcus Brigstocke, who's been performing here in the comedy tent. Hi, guys. Marcus.
Morning.
Well, it's bright and breezy here in Latitude, in this lovely, lovely place. Just wait till the new Prime Minister's revealed on Tuesday, Marcus. Imagine
so
if it's
exciting.
Boris Johnson,
yeah.
As everyone supposes. All the new comment material you got coming.
I know, so much, so easy. It'll be just like the Trump thing, where everybody assumes the worse the state of politics, the easier our job is. But when there's no space left beyond where they are for parody, it actually becomes more difficult.
You hear that a lot. And when I say new material with a new Prime Minister, are there any jokes left about Boris Johnson that haven't been told yet?
We'll see. I mean, the trouble is as well, most of the people who I know who write political comedy care a great deal about what's happening at the moment, arguably maybe too much to really find what's hilarious. These are, for a lot of people, very scary times. I'm very relieved
thought, yeah.
I'm not doing stand-up as myself at the moment. I'm on tour as Lucifer, doing stand-up, discussing the affairs of mortals as Lucifer. So I did it here the other day, and it's a lovely way of separating myself from the division and all the rest of it, and looking at mankind as this project.
Yeah, that, I can't get out of my head what you just said. The idea of a comedian struck dumb with mortification at what's going on around them.
Yeah. Well, that's exactly why I chose to paint myself red and glue horns to my forehead.
I just thought that's what you did at weekends. George, who'll be smiling most this time next week?
Well, I think journalists probably will be, because we're going to be covering probably Boris Johnson as Prime Minister, and that's going to give us plenty of copy over the coming years. I was reflecting on this, that the last 3 years have been crazy times, but with a pretty boring Prime Minister in charge. Now we're going to have very interesting times with Boris Johnson probably in charge. So that's going to be pretty exciting. It's going to be an amazing week next week. You haven't mentioned, of course, John, the fact there's another leadership contest going on. The Liberal Democrats choosing a new leader tomorrow.
I was just about to mention
A new leader of the Conservative Party on Tuesday, new Prime Minister on Wednesday. We're probably going to see Philip Hammond, the Chancellor, going out in a blaze of glory. He's meant to be packing his bags already in number 11 Downing Street. So it's going to be an amazing few days. So it's quite nice to get out of Westminster and spend a bit of time up here.
Got to say it is. In a second, we're going to catch up with John McDonnell, Labour's Shadow Chancellor, who's not here, but it's always good to talk. And later on, you're going to hear from the likes of the rock pianist Ben Folds, who is, and the artist, poet and singer Imelda May. And I recommend that one. I did it already. I'm looking forward to it. And I did it. But as I said, we're going to have music. So let's hear some music live here in our tent. We've got two tents, actually, about the size of the tent you put up in your garden when you have mates around for a barbecue. But we're not complaining. Rosa Walton, Jenny Hollingworth. The next big thing, some say, though they're pretty big now, frankly, and they're going to be playing, they are playing, experimental sludge pop. And I know you know what that is, so I needn't explain it to you. Obviously, I know what it is. So let's listen to Let's Eat Grandma. That's what they're called, by the way. It's not an invitation, guys.
Head in her scars, Ava studies her bum as she waits on the window seat. A pebble thrown over her arm, her face is dark in alarm. She says, oh, what do you want from me? I said, why'd you take it as final when you're starting to spiral, girl? Why can't you see? You know, I know you can do it, and I'll help you get through this. So whether it's once or twice or again and on.
Guys, that was very, very lovely. Rosa and Jenny Let's See Grandma. Lots of appreciation from us, and the vast crowd spread out in front of us on the on the grass. This is what it's like at the Obelisk stage at any given Saturday or Sunday night. They're going to be with us, I hope, for a while and listening to what we're saying, as well as to you guys. I have to ask you this. Thanks again for coming along. But sludge pop, what's that?
I mean, this song wasn't particularly sludge pop.
Yeah, I knew that.
I think some of our other songs. I mean, that's probably more first album.
Yeah,
that we did.
It was a term that we invented for our first album. We had a song called Chocolate Sludge Cake.
I think it's because we used a lot of drone notes for that record.
Yeah, and people would always ask us, "What genre do you call yourselves?" And we just made something up.
Yeah,
the whole post-sludge thing is really.
You're a bit behind. No, mate, I'm right up there.
Left sludge. Mind, yeah. To be honest.
I bet John McDonald's right up there. I bet you really like sludge pop, John McDonald, don't you?
Don't tell me you knew what sludge pop was before you at this interview, John Pienaar. I don't believe a word of it. I thought that was great anyway, by the way. Well done.
You're such a cynic. Anyway, by the way, well done. There you go. Congratulations from John McDonald, guys.
Thank you.
John, good to hear your voice, and thanks for joining us. You can tell we're starting to get into the summer mood a little bit here, but you know, there's an awful lot of politics going on this week, isn't there? I'm going to start with just something you've been on this weekend. You're promising, onto policy here just a bit, you've been promising, John, a change in the law to get local services provided by local councils. So can I just ask you straight away, the first question that certainly occurred to me and I bet a lot of people, will any council have to take on services that are being provided perfectly well by private contractors?
We've said that the preference should be in-house because that's what most people are telling us they want, that they want their local council to deliver their services because then they have more democratic control and they get a better service. We've said, though, local councils who feel they haven't got the capacity to deliver or there's a specialist service that they don't think they'll be able to provide, that they'll be able to outsource it as at present. But we are saying as well, you know, when councils outsource, they should ensure that those companies pay a proper living wage, a real living wage. They make sure they recognise their trade unions and that their staff are treated properly and also that their services are properly regulated. At the moment, the reason people want services brought back in-house is because they feel they're not getting the service quality they deserve. They lose control of it, but also they feel they've been ripped off. And if you look at some of the companies that have been leading the outsourcing, they've been making massive profits on our expense. And then sometimes, like Carillion, they overstretch themselves, go bust, and then we're left in the lurch. Mm. And as a result of that, I think people just want services back with their local councils.
But it's going to be up to the council, because I saw the CBI saying this idea was, they put it this way, said it was devoid of evidence and dripping in dogma. I mean, how right is that? Are councils going to be made in any way compelled to take this step? Because I know you've got a massive preference for in-house provision of services, public provision of services, John, haven't you?
We're saying the priority should be keep it in-house because that's what people want. And so the preference will reverse. At the moment, all the legislation of the last, well, four decades has been pushing councils, forcing them to outsource them, privatise them. And what we're saying, we're reversing that preference. The preference should be in-house delivery. If you want to go out-house because you haven't got the capacity, or as I say, there's some specialist areas that councils will say, we can't deliver this, but we can find an organisation. Sometimes it's a voluntary organisation or a co-op, not just a private company. Well, so be it. We'll leave that to the council to decide. But there will be criteria. We, you know, as I said, you've got to pay decent wages, recognise a trade union, make sure the service is properly regulated. But we're following what people are telling us. Overwhelmingly, people are rejecting privatisation and saying we want our services back under democratic control. And you know, I'll give you one example. Some contracts have been signed for sort of 10 years and then council, local people can't then retrieve it. Even if they vote for another council, the contract is signed and they can't reverse that for another 5 years or 10 years. I think that's, well, it's just not democratic.
But there's been a point. There was a point back in the day under Margaret Thatcher for sending council services out to private contractors because it's run by people who know business, who can do things efficiently, who've got incentives to do things efficiently because it saves money and that benefits everyone. That's how that argument goes. So what do you say about all of that?
Because it just didn't work.
Is it going to cost councils and the rest of us an awful lot more money?
No, it didn't work. And I tell you why it didn't work is because council after council at the moment...
It did in some cases, John, didn't it? It did work in some cases.
The bulk of the cases, the councils at the moment are bringing services back in-house because of poor delivery of service, because they're being ripped off. And what happens is, The council outsources the service. Profits are made at our expense. Shares and dividends are paid out at our expense. Often what you'll find is the service itself gets run down and you lose control of it. The companies are not held properly to account. And as I say, there's been example after example as well where those companies then go bust and we're left holding the baby. And I think what we need to do now is recognise what local people are saying. And, you know, councils themselves are bringing services back in-house, saving money, getting better value for money, and also making sure actually people's views are being listened to about the quality of those services.
Yeah, I mean, just really, you can apply the same arguments to Tesco's or to Sainsbury's or to Uber or to Apple, all of these companies which exist to make a profit, but in the process try to offer their customers the best value for money. So they buy those products and the products sell themselves by way of quality. You're making an argument in some senses, aren't you, just against the private market?
No, what we're saying is, do you know, there's some services that we traditionally have been delivered in the past by the local council. We've had this decades-long experiment of privatisation. It hasn't worked. And so what we're doing now is saying, let's look again at that. Let the councils themselves have the freedom to run their services and make sure in future that we listen to local people. That's what this is all about.
OK. I wanted to touch on that question of politics. It's genuinely interesting. But focusing on your party, because there's an awful lot, as you know better than anyone, going on there. And you know as well as anyone that the question of anti-Semitism in the Labour Party is one of the big questions, huge questions, hanging over the party. Very basic question, if I could. Would you promise to accept the judgment of the Equalities and Human Rights Commission inquiry into anti-Semitism in the Labour Party, whatever it says and recommends?
Oh, yes, I welcome the inquiry. I said, look, we should welcome this because I'm hoping. Yes. What I'm saying is, you won't know this, John, but I campaigned for the establishment of the commission. I campaigned against the cuts that have gone on in the commission itself because the number of staff that were cut back a number of years ago, I was on the demonstrations and picket lines to protect the organisation when the government was savaging it. So I'm protective of it. And I'm saying I welcome the inquiry. And what I want to say to everybody is, when the inquiry is over, and I want it quicker, actually, I need it speeded up, let's learn the lessons and then also work with the organisation to implement what recommendations they bring forward. On that basis, I'm hoping we'll get a clean bill of health, but more importantly, we can become much more effective at tackling not just anti-Semitism, but racism, both in our party and society overall.
Well, that was as clear an answer as anyone could hope to hear. And I guess it means that if the commission inquiry finds that there are senior individuals very close to the leader of the Labour Party who've been, as it's suggested, interfering in discipline cases against those accused of anti-Semitism in an entirely improper way, then you would expect those heads to roll.
I've just said to you, look, when they come back with their recommendations, we've got to cooperate, implement those recommendations, no matter how tough they are. I've welcomed the inquiry itself. You've just done a really leading question based upon a whole range of assumptions drawn from what's been in some parts of the media without evidence. Let's allow this independent inquiry to take place. Let's allow it to be independent, to take place, welcome it, and also let's hope it's speedy and we can get on with the job of tackling this problem.
Okay, that was a very straight answer, too. Thank you for that. George Parker.
John, if the Commission recommends that the question of disciplining people who are guilty of anti-Semitism or accused of anti-Semitism recommends that you have a wholly independent complaints procedure outside the Labour Party structures, would you go along with that?
Let's see what they come up with, George. The issue for me, and we're talking about this, as you know, we've got a special shadow cabinet on Monday and our National Executive Committee meets on Tuesday. I think there will be a discussion about how we can make the process more independent. There's lots of ideas on that. I'd welcome the Commission's ideas as well. But actually, I think we need to move more swiftly than the Commission on this, at least as a first stage until we get the full report from them. So therefore, I think in the discussions we have over the next few days,
an independent element.
Well, the idea is to learn some of the lessons and take up some of the criticisms that have been made. that will be part of the discussion over the next couple of days. And I'm hoping we can at least move some way in which to reassure the elements of independence that there already are and any improvements we can make to make it more independent in advance of any final recommendations from the Commission. Because, as I say, sometimes these inquiries can take over a year, and that's, for us, we need to be acting more swiftly.
That's definitely true. I'm wondering, with regard to that, what you can say that might take some of the heat out of the discourse online, because there are sort of battle lines that have been set up. These are not people who work for the Labour Party, may not even be members of the Labour Party, who have found themselves willingly or unwillingly drawn into a really nasty and hostile environment. And, you know, I look every day and I think, well, come on, you can say something here. You can show those people that what they're saying, the way they go after people like Tracey Ann Oberman and seek deliberately to isolate them online, you can do more.
Yeah, I think you're right. We've said,
you will.
No, Marcus, you're right. And the problem with this is that no matter how many times I or Jeremy say it, you still get these horrible people saying things, often in our name, and it is not in our name. And let me make it absolutely clear, because I've almost withdrawn some elements of Twitter. It's so ghastly, it's so vile. Let's make this absolutely clear. The research that we've done, the complaints that we've had, the vast bulk of them are not Labour Party members. Some of them portray themselves as supporters of Jeremy Corbyn or myself. Let me make this absolutely clear to these vile creatures. You do not do that in our name. You do not do that in our name. And we condemn you as much as any. We expect people to treat each other with respect. Yes, in politics, it can get heated. And at times, sometimes you go over the top. But if you look at what's been going on Twitter in particular, it is absolutely vile. And we say it time and time again. It is not in our name. Now, sometimes there's another element there. You have vile anti-Semites who are portraying themselves sometimes as our supporters. They are not. They are nothing to do with us. However, there are others then who are, I think, actually ill-educated on this issue and then get drawn in. So what we're doing now is we're developing our education programs, because, you know, actually, we've got to admit it, all of us. We live in a racist society. Anti-Semitism has been in this country since the medieval period, and we thought we were complacent. We thought we'd overcome it, not just in our party, but in society overall. We haven't. It exists, it's vile, and we've got to work together to tackle it. And I'm hoping, you know, we can work cross-party on this in Parliament, on all forms of how we tackle racism. And I welcome some of the statements that have been made by Savid Javid recently about this, about intolerant language, etc. And again, I just say this to all those out there, if you in any way using this as an issue, using abuse or whatever, you do not do it in our name. You have nothing to do with us. You are vile. You should disassociate yourselves from us, our party, or anything to do with our movement.
Okay, John, before we let you go, George has got one more.
Yeah, John, there's going to be a new Conservative Prime Minister, of course, on Wednesday, and the House of Commons rises on Thursday. Are you going to take the opportunity to put down a vote of no confidence in the new Prime Minister, stop them in their tracks?
What Jeremy has said, and I've said, is that we'll put down the vote of no confidence when we're confident that we can carry it. So that will be a judgment that we'll make.
That'll be a no, then.
Well, most probably, if you look at what's happening in the Tory party at the moment, and you've seen what Keir Starmer has said today on our behalf, is the priority for us is to prevent a no-deal Brexit. So we will be working across party in the House of Commons, including with Conservative MPs, and I'll be working with Philip Hammond if necessary, to prevent a no-deal. That's our priority. Now, if a no-confidence vote becomes part of that strategy, we'll use it.
Okay. The more no-deal is talked about, the more I think people forget that all of the deals will be bad. You know, no deal is mentioned again and again and again. And of course, it would be the worst case scenario. But people should not lose sight, nor should you, John McDonald, of the fact that every scenario in which we leave the European Union will leave the country vulnerable and leave us in a worse position, where the poorest and most vulnerable people in the UK, at least for the short and maybe medium term, are in a worse state than they have been as members of the European Union.
Okay. That's why I'm campaigning for another referendum, and in that referendum I'll campaign for Remain.
Okay, John, it's good to talk to you this morning. You can tell by the, well, this beautiful summer morning, the hush during that conversation of the people stretched in front of this tent, as far as the eye can see, just absolutely absorbed by that conversation. Thanks for joining us this morning. They're tuning up in the BBC tent over to my right. So I've been speaking to the rock pianist and singer Ben Folds just ahead of the show. He's really big in America and everywhere else, actually, since the 1990s. And I'm very glad that I did. He can certainly really play, and he can also really talk about US politics, about President Trump, if you raise the subject, which I did. Let's just have a listen to this first.
UK was the first territory where my band broke in the 90s. So, you know, we couldn't get arrested back in the States, and we had like a hit here, and that bounced back over the States and to Australia. So, yeah, I mean, I feel like the UK audience always got my sense of humor, understood that I was making a joke and that it wasn't funny, and so we understood each other.
Yeah. And when it comes to the British people, have you got a particular notion of what the British people are, what they're like?
I'd say the George Orwell essay on it pretty much, you know, that summed it up pretty well. I think he wrote a really great essay on the British people, and I think it hasn't changed that much since then. It was interesting about class and the way people feel about each other and how it's bound together. So that would be, you know, I go with George.
Yeah. Was that the one about where the left wing in society are the, almost the only one who have almost no time for their own country? Wasn't that right?
What I recall about it was a lot about class and how the various classes tend to dodge each other or aspire to be the other, and accents change accordingly, and aristocracy gets soft after a while, and that shuffles under, and you have these cycles, but you know, also like Little Britain, I think that's an awesome way to see the UK for an American, you know, because it does make it seem little, like they're in these little places, and it just seems so. I remember
it's
when I
a terrible depiction of Britain. I know it's really, really funny.
Oh yeah, yeah.
But
yeah,
it's unbelievably unflattering and quite unpleasant, isn't it?
Well, yeah, because it's comedy, but I mean, you understand that it's not really like that, but what you do take away from it is a sense of coziness that this little island has that is not as obvious from the United States when you see it on television. Mm. It seems bigger. I used to play a television show here, walk out in the streets, and everyone's like, you know, we can give you a high five, it's not too English, but it'd be like, yeah, we just saw you on television. At home, you play on TV, it's like, get in line. You're like one of thousands that have played at that moment. Yeah. And I like that feeling over here. It's less that way now, but I still like it.
Less that way now. And you'll know that at the moment, Britain is in not an especially comfortable place. And yeah, fantastically divided. In America, you'll know a lot about that.
Same.
Deeply divided, factionalism, certain amount of populist politics going on. But do you pick up that while you're here?
We were here when Brexit happened. I was on tour, and we left that morning, actually. Woke up in the airport hotel and watched the great surprise on television. I feel like everyone I was around, associated with, that was in my business, thought it was a terrible thing. So I haven't met anyone who thought it was a good idea yet. You know, so from my point of view, it looks like something everyone thinks is a bad idea. But I'm sure someone thought it was a good idea.
I suppose maybe a bit like America in that regard.
Totally.
That maybe in the sort of creative industries, in a certain slice of society, that would be the prevailing view.
Yeah.
But by definition, there's a large swathe of the British public, just as there's a large swathe of the American public, who are very happy with the direction that Donald Trump's taken America. So deeply polarized and big blocks of opinion on either side.
Yeah, and I grew up in the South, and the working class South at that. And so, I mean, I'm pretty familiar. I grew up in Trump country, really. So,
were you ever in any way inclined to be a Trump person?
Well, my first education, my first understanding of how the world worked, came from a very small perspective in the South. And you know, you learn as a kid, like, okay, 2 + 2 = 4. Okay, that's good. Right wing good, left wing bad. Okay, I mean, you learn that to begin with, but as you travel a little bit, you see it doesn't add up, especially when you begin to learn a few facts and nuance some things. I mean, what's going on in America is very much like here. If you don't pay a lot of attention, some of those catchphrases and some of the sentiments and fear that it plays on is very effective. But, you know, if you're a critical thinker at all and you spend any time looking at it, it melts.
Yeah. And when you're on stage as it were. I know you're very careful not to go too deeply into politics because for the reason you've given yourself, which it is just so divisive, and why go too far down that road?
Well, I think that, you know, music is, well, music's for almost anything. Music can be to divide. Music can be to go to war. Music can be to sing a love song. You know, we like to say it's a unifying force, but everyone has a different method and a different reason for making music. And to me, like, my audience sings a lot of three-part harmonies. It's amazing to hear people sing in harmony. If I want to bust that and I don't want to hear that three-part harmony, yeah, mention politics and it's all gone. I'm not afraid of losing an audience on it. It's not really about that, and it's not that I feel like music has to have some pure sense of bringing people together. But for my gig, I feel like my job is to make make people, for maybe not forget, but we leave that out to a degree. Although my songs have a lot of subtext and a lot of underpinnings of things that might be viewed as political, but not overtly political, not horse race political.
Is it difficult to keep that step back sometimes? When you look at, let's say, what's going on at the moment, the row about President Trump, for clearly tactical, strategic, conscious reasons, targeting those four members of Congress who are not white, with plainly racist tweets. Does that tempt you to dive in, as I put it before?
Well, I mean, no, because, I mean, firstly, I'm not a politician. I think what makes it very difficult, these times make it difficult for a musician who's a songwriter to write songs, because the news cycle and people's just jumping up and down like Mexican jumping beans.
That'd be us.
Yeah, well, it's us. It's us as the crowd. But it's like, you know, if I play to that, then as soon as my song comes out in 3 days or 6 weeks or whenever, we're on to the next thing and to try to chase that. I think the other thing is you don't want someone you don't agree with setting the narrative. And, you know, when he's in the entertainment business. I recognize that because I'm in the entertainment business. Sure. So as soon as I was aware of him, you know, I remember telling my father that the guy looks like he's a showman. He's in the entertainment business.
So you're singing off his song sheet and not yours, right?
Exactly. You know, I don't want to look on his set list. I would rather set mine if I were a politician. Very difficult to do because he's a very powerful performer.
You know? Lovely to talk to you. Thanks very much indeed.
Thank you. Good to talk to you.
That was Ben Folds talking to me just a short while ago. You might just hear any second a deep bassy sound of them warming up and sound checking in the BBC Sounds tent.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live, available on the BBC Sounds app. Pienaar's Politics.
And I'm John Pienaar, and we're at Latitude, live at Latitude in Suffolk, in the sun. We're under a tent, but it's very, very sunny, very, very nice here. And there's a crowd in front of the tent. I said it was vast. I mean, that was kind of poetic.
You can hardly see the grass down there. It's so packed.
But maybe a good dozen people, guys. Let's not undersell it.
They're crowd surfing towards us.
And what they may lack in numbers, they make up in absorbed interest, or relatively absorbed interest. Let's say hello to one or two of them. Hello, Madam Tricia.
Hi.
How's your festival going?
Oh, it's first time at the festival, and it's been lovely being in the Latitude bubble. Very enriching, enhancing, as in contrast to our political dimension at the moment, which I feel very, very sad about. I think of the children listening to things about how broken we are, how scary things are, and I really, as a grandparent, quite worried about that.
You've got to tell us now, Tricia. I didn't prime you to say all that, did I?
No,
it was my producer that primed you to say all that.
He's glad I did say it now and get it out of the way for the rest of the day.
I think the festival might have trouble getting you to go home by the sounds of it, Tricia. I think you live here, don't you?
Yeah, and thank you for your song on was it Friday night? I've lost the days, but yeah, in the cabaret, yeah.
Oh, yeah, that was fun.
Yeah, it was.
I love the idea
of we're in a musical.
Bubble here. We got out of the Westminster bubble to get right into another bubble.
The best bubble there is.
And next to you, Steve, you're with Tricia.
That's right. I am, yes.
Are you escaping the bubble to get into this bubble?
Escaping the bubble to get into this bubble, yes. But soon escaping out of this bubble to get back into the bubble that seems to be very depressing politics at the moment for me. Brexit is just a bad idea. I don't think there's any deal that would be better than the deal that we've got at the moment.
And just, I really for, think just for balance, I want to say it's a terrible idea.
Okay.
And just for more, but I will point out, we're going to hear from Damien Green.
Thanks for that alternative view, anyway.
I should point that out tediously. We're going to talk to Damien Green, which was not tedious, the former Tory Deputy Prime Minister, who does not think Brexit is terrible. Or if he does, he made a good effort to hide it. Jane, you're next to these guys. Hello, how are you finding it?
At Latitude, you mean?
Yeah.
We're having a super time. This is our family weekend. We have one every year, and all 13 of us are here. And I'm really celebrating today because tonight is going to be my last night ever under canvas.
Well, you've loved it that much.
Yes, but the daytimes have been great.
All right, OK. So, Imelda May, I promised you Imelda May. Let's hear from Imelda May, Irish singer, poet, artist. She had a mesmerising installation up on the hill just over from where I'm sitting. It was like a peaceful but chaotic bedroom in a Perspex cube. And she explains, you'll hear what she explains about what that was all about in just a second, but she's been in there at 11 o'clock in the evening creating poetry in front of whoever turned up. And I grabbed her for a chat ahead of this show, and I asked her just to tell me what that was all about.
It's all the things that I need to write on my comforts. And that's why I have a lot of ritual things, because most humans find comfort in some kind of ritual. And I wanted to have that without the elements of religion. And we have church pews where people can come and sit, and we're at the very end of the festival. So it's like a meditative space. And I encourage people to write poetry and hang them on the walls. So it's a place where you can just contemplate. Yeah.
So it's a place of peace and creativity. It's kind of beautiful, but it's not at all organised. And that's...
organized chaos, like my life and my
organized chaos.
Like
now your music, home. Your music. So we're going to hear some of your music. We're going to play some of your music. But describe your music just for me yourself.
It's from my heart. That's all I can say. I write from my heart. Whatever. I follow my art, and it leads me to where I want to be. And my creative process is always led by that. And I just go with the flow of that.
All right, we're going to have a little listen to it now.
Put it down, then I pick it back up. Praying for your name to pop up. Telling me that you're still in love with me.
But a bit about you. So you came to this country around 2000, around the turn of the century, and you stayed. So I guess it agrees with you.
Yes. Yeah, I came for a weekend, and I ended up staying over 20 years. And I've met a lot of wonderful people, and a lot of my work is based here. And
are you comfortable with the country which you live in now? A lot's happened since 2000. An awful lot has happened over the last couple of years.
Yes.
I'd like to hear your perspective on all of that as a kind of an outsider, as it were, on the inside. What do you make of it?
I honestly find it disturbing. I think it's rattled me to the core. I think there's a dark undercurrent going along the world, which we have to stop, and we have to use our votes and our voices to do that. I don't think I'm an artist, so I'm a typical, as much as I love punk rock, there's a hippie screaming from within me, just screaming love and acceptance and compassion. And I remember reading a quote that somebody was asked, how should we treat others? I think it was Gandhi. How should we treat others? And he said, there are no others. It's only us. And that is the way I feel about everything. But there's a division going on, and it's I think it's toxic.
Toxic and dark is how you've described it. And there was a speech, Theresa May. I went to a speech the other day by Theresa May. I don't know if you're a fan of Theresa May or not, but she spoke about some of the changes that have been happening away from compromise, towards populism, towards factionalism.
I'm not a fan of what she's done to the Windrush generation by any means, no.
But on that message, away from compromise, towards populism, I'm guessing you got some sympathy with that?
I think whatever divides, I think there seems to be a tactic going on in the world by a lot of leaders, certainly by Trump, to divide, and I do think that's... I don't think that's accidental. I think he's trying to do the old divide and rule, divide and conquer, and pitch people against each other. I think he's a very... I think he makes out that he's stupid, but I think he's very, very clever. And he often he will often try and distract us with something ridiculous to turn our heads away from what he's actually doing. And I do think there is a lot of that going on over here as well, and there's a lot of people studying that and taking notes. And
who have you got in mind when you say
Farage? 100%. And I don't know, I think it's the dark side, definitely. I think it's what disturbs me is, and I've looked into this a lot and I've written about this, there are two emotions according to the experts of the world, and one is love and the other is fear. And I think you can go for one or the other, and I think a lot of people at the moment are trying to lead by fear, and that's where they're, all the negative emotions come in.
You
from
mentioned, you mentioned Nigel Farage, you haven't mentioned Boris Johnson. How does he fit into this picture?
He's a
funny guy, you know, he cheers people up, he makes people feel good about themselves a lot of the time. How does it work with you?
If I'm getting into a plane, I want the pilot to be able to be educated enough to fly that plane. I don't need them to entertain me.
I'll take it from that. You don't think he's a qualified pilot or a qualified prime minister?
Absolutely not. I don't think I like people with conviction, and I think the man is convicted to himself, and I think he likes to change his policies, or definitely his speeches, to whatever makes him more popular.
Imelda May there, artist, poet, singer, and definitely not a huge fan of Boris Johnson. But I'll tell you who is, or at least seems to be, a very big fan of Boris Johnson, someone I bumped into just a short while ago. It's the former Deputy Prime Minister, in all but name, Damian Green. And he's a Latitude regular. And like most Tory MPs, as I say, he's a Boris Johnson supporter. But then who among Tory MPs is not a Boris Johnson supporter? And that seems to be the case very much ever since it's been clear that he was most likely to win. I don't know how far those two things are connected. I asked Damian Green when we met if he was here at Latitude relaxing, or if he was just trying to escape politics for a blissful day or two.
Politics is no more fun from the inside over the past few years than it has been looking on from the outside. You know, Brexit and everything that's flown from it has caused huge difficulties. Parliament has failed to cope with that. We've not been able to agree a Brexit deal, which is what the British people told us to do, and that has raised a level of almost contempt for politics, which I've never seen in my political lifetime before. Mm. And so getting away from that for a few days is good for the soul.
Yeah. I mean, I haven't seen it before, and my memory of watching politics closely goes back something like 40 years, and that's nothing in the sweep of things, but it's still unlike anything we've seen before. And we saw Boris Johnson at that last big rally the other night, calling for unity in the Conservative Party. Well, it'd be good for him, obviously, he'd like it if the party unified behind him, but unity of that kind or any other kind, it's just not going to happen anytime soon, is it?
Well, you've got to start the journey. He's absolutely right to say, not just, I think, in the party, but looking more widely in the country as well. And I mean, one of the reasons I'm supporting Boris is that when you look back to his time as Mayor of London, London was a happy city. I mean, yeah, any big city has problems all the time. But actually, London got better under Boris as mayor, despite, you know, the diversity and all the clashes you expect in a city like London. Actually, that can work, and I hope that can be a template for the country. We have had a rough few years, and you know, we need to start making the journey out of that towards not just a better politics, but a better society.
When you look at the promises that are being made by, let's take Boris Johnson as a good example, he's the front runner right now, and he's saying, look, we can leave the European Union with no deal, and the Europeans are going to sit down with us and immediately start thrashing out a wonderful deal, you know, pretty much immediately after we leave with no deal, and hanging on to the money that we owe them. That is completely arguably phony as a prospectus, isn't it?
No, I don't agree with that. I think, and particularly, I mean, take the point about the money, that obviously the Europeans want that money, so if they think they're not going to get it, then that will...
Well, they won't sit down with us until the pledge is made good. It's not handed over all at once, but the pledge is acted on, as promised.
Well, there needs to be an active negotiation. It's perfectly clear, sadly, that the withdrawal agreement that the European Union and the British government agreed is not going to get through the House of Commons. It failed three times. So there has to be a new type of agreement that gets us to the eventual trade agreement we got.
Damien, can you look me in the eye right now? So look me in the eye right now and tell me this is going to work as promised, and look as if you mean it, because I'm not convinced.
Yeah, I think you can do that. I think that one of the things that's gone wrong is that we got the negotiating sequence wrong. There are certain technical things you can discuss, but I've said all along that it's not just in our interest to have a deal, because I think it is in our interest to have a deal. It's actually in the European Union's interest to have a deal.
I mean, for the sake of discussion, it's not over yet. There'll be a result on Tuesday, but let's just focus on Boris Johnson. We've got limited time, and all the money seems to be riding on him. On a scale of, and look me in the eye while you answer this one too, on a scale of 1 to 10, how great a Prime Minister is Boris Johnson going
to
be?
He has every chance of being a great
Prime Minister. On a scale of 1 to 10.
On a scale of 1 to 10, 10.
10 out of 10.
I think let's...
And you're not looking me in the eye, you know that, right?
Now is the time... Boris has been accused of peddling optimism. That's one of his good points. I think it's important that one of the ways out of the toxic politics we've had over the past few years is to have some optimism. And Boris believes that Britain can become, again, a country where we...
All the substance you could wish for in a potential Prime Minister. All the character, all of the ability to take tough decisions and take things seriously. He's not famed for taking things seriously, or even anything very seriously.
Well, I think that's not true. Again, I mean, look at his record in office as Mayor of London. You wouldn't say that. And also, I've heard, obviously, his pitch that he's been making around these rather good, very big hustings meetings. A lot of it is about infrastructure. It's about transport infrastructure and how that can regenerate communities who've been left behind. That's addressing the underlying issues that many of us, including me, believe caused the Brexit vote. It wasn't just about Europe. It was about communities that feel they've been left behind in a sort of globalised world.
There'll be two categories of Conservative MP just at the moment. There are those who are waiting to bring the government down, and there are those who are desperate to join it. Which one are you in?
I try never to be desperate, but absolutely, I'm not one of those who wants to bring a Conservative government down. I think that would be wrong.
They would do that rather than let us leave the EU without a deal, though, wouldn't they?
Well, if they say so, then they might. But I think that would be profoundly wrong. I've always said, argued very strongly, that no deal would be bad for Britain, and I continue to believe that. But I also believe really strongly that a Corbyn government would be even worse. And any Conservative MP who is saying, I am prepared to risk a Corbyn government to try and keep Britain in the European Union, is, I think, playing with fire.
That's Damian Green telling me that he believes Boris Johnson could be a 10 out of 10 Prime Minister, and Brexit is going to work faultlessly, and meaning every word of that. I know he meant every word of that, because he told me that he meant every word of that. And if you don't believe anything I'm saying, they're tuning up the organ on the Obelisk stage, and you can listen to that instead. In the meantime, let's say hi to Lolly Jones, comedian and burlesque artist, who I had the pleasure of seeing perform just yesterday. Hi, Lolly.
Hello.
Thanks for joining us in the tent. It was like nothing I've ever seen. I liked it. The audience liked it. There you were. Theresa May in stockings and suspenders, dancing and lip-syncing Mrs. May's best-known lines at various important times in her premiership. They were mostly bad moments, obviously. Where did you get that idea from?
I think it was her awkward body language that just lends itself so well to burlesque. It's the total opposite of it.
Really?
And especially when she started doing her robotic dancing, if you mix that with taking off your stockings and having your blue rosette nipple pasties, I think it's just weird. But also, there's something so sad about what's happening at the moment.
Are you sad about what's happening at the moment?
I'm devastated about what's happening at the moment. Well, first of all, even though I do not like Theresa May, I was gutted that she resigned because my career is over. I think whatever side of the fence you're on, it's absolutely devastating what's happening. Particularly like all my family voted to leave, and I voted Remain, but we've never been more united because we're all united in our complete devastation about what's happening.
Okay, but she is off now. Come Tuesday, she'll no longer be the Prime Minister. Mm. Mind you, looking at your show yesterday, that doesn't necessarily have to slow you down. You had Boris Johnson up there.
Yeah.
I mean, he wasn't in tights and suspenders,
not
but he
yet.
Was part of the show. Not yet. And Michael Gove, I think that was Michael Gove, he was there too. So you can just go and run, right?
I can, yeah. And I do lots of different characters. So in my new Edinburgh show, I Believe in Miracles, at Assembly Roxy, 8 o'clock every night in the Edinburgh Fringe.
Everybody gets a plug on this.
I play Angela Merkel, and I put her on a hoverboard because she's so boring that I have to make her slightly interesting. You saw me do Marine Le Pen yesterday.
Yeah.
Just lip sync French.
Yeah.
In lingerie.
Yeah.
And yeah. So and I also
do you ever depict any politician that you can stand?
No, because it's not really that fun otherwise. Yeah. Although, to be fair, Nicola Sturgeon as well. She's almost like a hero when I do her. She always comes off really well, and I think that's because she answers questions honestly, or as honestly as she can.
These are wise words for someone who's playing the Edinburgh Festival for a month. Nicola's fine.
I'm not stupid, obviously. Yeah, I do. So my dancers have feather fans, and they sort of like dance around me as I'm talking about how Brexit has ruined the country as Nicola Sturgeon. But I think she's really funny because the way she talks, it's almost like actual jokes. Her speech are built like jokes. She does toppers on top of what she's saying. And I even put a little ba-da-bum ch in some of it. You didn't see this bit yesterday, you saw an abridged version. But in the full-length version, she takes her clothes off as well. And she has this live jazz band behind her, and she's just sort of doing these gags as she's warming up. Yeah. She, you know, I think she said about Theresa May, where she said, she's the only person who's tried to fall on her own sword and has managed to miss.
That's right.
are there any female Conservative politicians who do give you grounds for hope for your career? Liz Truss, maybe?
Do you know what? I think
Priti Patel, Amber Rudd.
No one's really got anything defining about them physically. No. I think they've got to be interesting physically. Because I did Angela Eagle last year. Obviously, she's Labour, but it didn't really work because she's just a bit dull. And Theresa, no matter what you think of her, well, we probably all think the same about her, to be fair.
I'm sure Angela Eagle's breaking her heart. Didn't manage to do
that. I love Angela Eagle, but come on, that leadership launch was just horrendous.
A slow burlesque reveal of an actual Truss, an actual Liz Truss.
Yeah.
There might be something in there.
I think it's a bit too niche.
Sure.
Yeah.
maybe a bit too on the nose, too specific.
Yeah. That's true, yeah.
So you're competing now, by the way, with Lana Del Rey on the obelisk stage, getting
ready. Oh, is that her warming up?
Well, it's either her or it's a tape. I was going to fudge that question just to add to the drama of the thing. Looking ahead, we're really nearly running out of time. Looking ahead to this week. Are we looking ahead to this week? It's going to be extraordinary, isn't it, Mark?
It is, yes, because my play opens at the Omnibus Theatre tomorrow. Thank you, John. The Red opens for four preview nights at the Omnibus Theatre before running at the Edinburgh Festival for a month.
Yeah, and there's other stuff going on too, isn't there?
There is. I believe we'll have a new Prime Minister by the middle of the week, which is terrifying. But fortunately, I'm also doing Devil May Care, my Lucifer show, where I will be talking in great detail about our new Prime Minister.
We take a liberal approach to plugs.
Yes, it's thanks, John.
Got to be. What do you reckon, George? I mean, you're going to be around. We're all going to be packed into Westminster these coming days. And you mentioned earlier, we've got a Liberal Democrat leadership.
Yes. Yeah,
so enthronement.
Well, yeah, that's happening tomorrow. It's, you may have missed it. It's between Joe Swinson and Ed Davey. I would guess it's going to be Joe Swinson. I think the party wants to be sort of go for a younger face, more of an anti-establishment figure. Ed Davey suffers a bit from being middle-aged and being called Sir Ed Davey, I thought, on that front. And then, of course, the drama of the change of power, which always is gripping, isn't it? You have the helicopters in the sky. You know, probably the prospect of Boris Johnson going down the Mall to kiss hands with the Queen to become Prime Minister. It will be a moment of high drama. And then the formation of a cabinet. And then the House of Commons breaks up for a summer holiday the next day. Going to be...
He has set himself an impossible task, and one that he hasn't even prepared for, I believe. So it'll be interesting to see.
Yeah, he's going to be zipping off around Europe, isn't he? Or hoping to zip off around Europe and grab various... Well, some of your
favourite
subjects.
Yeah,
Merkel, among others. You don't do Emmanuel Macron in your set. You've got to work on that one.
Yeah.
He's got this Iran crisis going on. He's got Brexit crisis. The European leaders want to know what his policy is straight away. I mean, it's the most awful political situation for any Prime Minister to come into. It's going to absolutely... he's going to be a baptism on fire.
A bed entirely of his own making.
Yeah. He still seems to be smiling, though, doesn't he? I guess.
Yeah, because he's been gearing up for this since he was born. He's going to enjoy it so much. That's the worst thing. He's going to love it.
And we're going to have the soap opera of whether he moves into Downing Street with his partner, Carrie Symons, as well, which is an interesting one.
So many soap operas. And we're going to be wondering, when's the general election? Because, you know, the money's going to start going now on a general election very, very soon.
Yep. I mean, there's a possibility he could be forced to hold an election in the autumn. And even if he isn't, I think he's got his eyes set on a general election sometime in the spring or summer next year. So I'm afraid to say that within a year, it's almost certainly going to be voting again.
A snap election to shore up their position. Those work well, don't they?
Yeah. Do you think the Brexit party will have any policies by that time?
They don't need one. They've only got one, haven't they?
Well, someone very wise said, as the obelisk works hard to drown us out, remind us we're nearly running out of time, that calling a snap election, it is a be careful what you wish for. Yes. That is the lesson when it comes to general elections. And you'll have lots more material, Lolly, anyway, as will Marcus.
That's true. I do. There's a bit in my show where I bring Theresa back as a zombie and hold awake for her career. Yeah. So I'll just run with that. She can be coming back from the dead.
In our next show, we're going to have a performer who does a fantastically flattering depiction of Theresa May, if we can find such a thing. That's it for us from Latitude. It's been lovely having you with us. It's been lovely having you all with us, listening in. And on the crowd, we'll give you a wave and the crowd.
Thank you, the crowd.
The crowd, an electric spark going up from there. That's it from us.
BBC Radio 5 Live.